Malcolm Turnbull was Prime Minister of Australia for 3 years between 2015 and 2018 before being toppled by Scott Morrison. It was the end of a tumultuous political career which began under John Howard and included a first stint as Liberal leader between 2008 and 2009 before being ousted by Tony Abbott by a single vote. In his memoir, A Bigger Picture, Malcolm Turnbull lays bare the Machiavellian machinations of the party room and, as he describes it, the guerrilla warfare conducted against him as Prime Minister by leadership aspirants Tony Abbott and Peter Dutton. Malcolm Turnbull says his and any other attempts at climate change policy are hopelessly undermined by a toxic alliance between politics and parts of the media. He says one of the biggest issues facing Australia now is climate change. And as we said, it's been politicised by successive governments. At a recent COP26 summit in Glasgow, he poured scorn over Australia's promises, saying, quote, "Australia has never been more out of step on a global issue with its friends and allies than it is on climate." Malcolm Turnbull's memoir is called A Bigger Picture. He is with us from the Hunter Valley. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Great to be with you.
Thank you very much for your time. I enjoyed the book very much.
Oh, that's great. Good.
Let's begin with COP and climate, and then we'll work back to how this works in Australia. You're not long back from COP26 in Glasgow. What's your assessment of the success or otherwise of that summit?
Well, it wasn't as inspiring as Paris, but it wasn't the train wreck of Copenhagen. I think there was some progress made, not by Australia, I'm afraid to say, but you know, all of the developed world, apart from Australia, increased its 2030 targets. You saw, agreement to reduce methane emissions by many countries, unfortunately not including Australia. As a general rule, I think there was progress, and you know, John Kerry, the President Biden's climate envoy, did a very good job marshalling the business community. I've never seen so much enthusiasm from the finance sector. Mark Carney played a role there too, I should add. And, big business generally getting behind the need to cut emissions as quickly as we can. I mean, I think it's fair to say that civil society and business, with the exception of the fossil fuel sector, of course, is much further ahead on this issue than many, if not most, governments.
Well, then let's look at Australia and what it brought to the table and why. And is its offering still hampered by the kind of toxic triangle, I think you would say, of the industry interests, certain parts of the media, and then their political players in Parliament? Is it still that seriously hampered, or is there something else behind that offering you criticise?
Yeah, it absolutely is. One of the luckiest things you have in New Zealand is that you don't have a strong presence from the Murdoch media there. You can see the damage that Fox News has done to the United States, probably more damage than any other group. You look at what Murdoch does in Australia; it's essentially constantly pushing the politics of the right. When I say the right, I don't mean conservatives. I mean, I would regard myself in many respects as a political conservative. I'm talking about the politics of division, of populism, denying the reality of global warming, even down to denying the reality of COVID. You've got that sort of divisive popular stream in the media supporting a similar body of opinion in politics, and then of course you've got the fossil fuel sector that desperately want to keep on mining coal and pumping gas. So it's that has been a toxic troika in Australia, and it's done us enormous damage. I mean, the terrible tragedy of it is, leaving aside the overwhelmingly important point of saving the planet, the terrible tragedy is that Australia is very, very well positioned to be a renewable energy superpower. We have huge land mass. We have lots of land which can be used for solar, and is being used for solar already, but it's massive areas of which are very high levels of radiation and not a lot of alternative uses for the land. We've got obviously similar opportunities in wind. As long as we plan ahead and are smart, and you know, one of the things I got started, which is being built now, is a big pumped hydro scheme, the Snowy Hydro 2.0. As long as we plan for the transition, you know, we could be a zero emission economy and reap all the benefits of getting there quickly. But, you know, regrettably, vested interests and the political factors we just spoke about are holding things up.
You go into them in great detail. Let's look, for example, at in round one of your leadership, trying to get an emissions trading scheme through, its history, a political graveyard in Australia, including for Labor, as was ultimately the carbon tax with Julia Gillard's infamous words.
Which were tragically a mistake, you know, because, I mean, heavens knows why. Just, I make this point in the book. I mean, when Gillard said that the emissions trading scheme she was seeking to legislate was a carbon tax, it wasn't a carbon tax at all. I mean, in the language of, you know, putting a price on carbon, a carbon tax is regarded as something that has a fixed price, you know, $20 a tonne, $30 a tonne of CO2 equivalent. But what Julia was proposing was an emissions trading scheme with a fixed price for a couple of years.
Why do you think she said that infamously in that interview that missed actually by the interviewers at the time? Was it because, and you have shown this over and over again, there's kind of a Alice in Wonderland effect to things that get said in Australian politics? And did she feel if she didn't say those words, no carbon tax, then even though what she was proposing wasn't a carbon tax, it would have been used against her?
Well, it was worse. I mean, she said no carbon tax, which was fine, but then she later said that her emissions trading scheme could be described as a carbon tax. So you know, she created a trap, and then a trap of her own design, and then jumped into it. I mean, there was one of her very close colleagues at the time said to me that he thought she had done this in order to differentiate it from what Kevin Rudd had proposed. I mean, the emissions trading scheme is like, honestly, it does your head in just reflecting on the history. So the history for your listeners who probably quite sensibly have tuned out of Australian politics for most of the time, but it was actually originally proposed by John Howard in 2006-07, when I was John's environment minister in 2007. We actually started legislating for an emissions trading scheme. Now, John Howard went to the 07 election with an emissions trading scheme as his policy, as his government's policy. And it remained the coalition's policy, that's to say the Liberal National Party's coalition, which is the centre-right side of politics in Australia. It remained our policy until, you know, I was deposed as Liberal leader the first time by Abbott in a sort of right-wing insurgency over precisely the issue of the emissions trading scheme, which Rudd had also had it as his policy, and Rudd was seeking to legislate it. So he was effectively seeking to legislate John Howard's policy, but the coalition internal, you know, factions rose up and or the right wing rose up and blew the show up. And so then you got down the track with Abbott and the whole, you know, Tony's essentially a climate change denialist. You know, his immortal words, what, climate change is crap or something, words something similarly pithy. That then, from that moment on, from the end of 2009, the climate issue has been utterly weaponized, and it's become essentially an identity issue, so that people talk about believing or disbelieving in global warming, which is about as sensible as saying you believe or disbelieve in gravity, and it's become an identity issue. Okay. That essentially divides politics in tribes. And I mean, you see this in the US, I mean, even more consequentially, of course.
Tell me more about these relationships with the media, though, because you actually spoke to Murdoch directly yourself Rupert yourself.
Oh, many times. I've known him for nearly 50 years.
I think of course, you've got a long history. You were the lawyer for Kerry Packer, infamously kept Kerry Packer out of jail in the short form of the story, certainly as many tell it, right? So you know the media well, and you're an investor. You helped bring The Guardian Australia, helped promote that idea and get that up and running as well. So you know this industry well. But you... at times, I think it was another attack on your leadership, went to him directly, and he made the point to you that many others have, no one watches Sky after dark. You know, this is when Sky television gets particularly interesting. And he tried to play down the impacts of or some of the shock jocks. I don't think anyone would call Alan Jones a small player, but he tried to play that down. But can you explain more about exactly how it would work between parts of that media, the Murdoch media in particular, and the politicians, many of whom were sitting around your cabinet table?
Well, look, what's happened is, in my, you know, lifetime, and I would say, you know, and I mean, I'm so contextualize this, I'm 67, you know, and I worked as a journalist in my early 20s. And I've been involved in the media one way or another for a very long time. What's happened is that you've seen the right-wing media in particular, more so than the sort of progressive or liberal left media, have become essentially propaganda. You know, there was a time when a right-wing newspaper, a conservative newspaper, say, take like the Daily Telegraph in London, you know, would lean to the right, but would still, you know, would report the news straight. The tabloids were a little more, unshackled by connections with reality, but they weren't taken as seriously. But now you've got a situation where news, because of the internet, digital channels, you know, pay television, etc., people can basically choose the news they want to hear. And so you can be best described, I think, as monetizing a market for crazy. And so, again, the best example, and this is the best insight into Murdoch's business model, is Fox News in the United States. You know, where they have been, you know, they had a big role in, probably the biggest single role in making Trump president. They promoted the idea that Trump had actually won the election last year and that Joe Biden had stolen, which was complete fantasy and denial of all the facts. You know, they've obviously been huge opponents of taking effective action on global warming. They've, you know, got hosts that regularly criticize, you know, the wearing of masks, the need for vaccines. You know, like, it's just, it's crackers. And you have to say, you know, who benefits from this? Well, certainly not the society, certainly not public health, certainly not the most important democracy in the world. I mean, this sort of right-wing market for crazy has done enormous damage to the United States. It is more divided and angry than it's ever been since the Civil War, and it's very, very dangerous. And frankly, this is why public broadcasters like Radio New Zealand, like the ABC in Australia, like the BBC in the UK, are more important than ever. Because the other broadcasters I mentioned are obliged to actually stick to the facts and, you know, make sure that opinion is balanced and reasonable and so forth.
What is it with the politicians, though? Because the venality of the behaviour, as you outline it in this book, as you portray it in this book, in great detail, using your diary entries, is way more venal than any argument over vested interests or need to pay back supporters or need to look after the voters in this part of Western Australia. It is pure naked ambition, as you portray it and report it here, driving the decisions of any number of players. Now, to what extent were those members of your party and your cabinet room, you know, necessarily responding to what they have to do with the media and in order to you know to keep up the votes for the party in all sorts of different demographics. And to what extent was that liaison purely about personal ambition? Because reading it the way you write it for Dutton, for Abbott, and quite possibly for Scott Morrison, it was the latter that dominated their behaviour.
Well, look, some politicians see politics as a means of getting things done. You know, now I'm very much in that category. I've always regarded that power without purpose is pointless. So I've always wanted to do things, and my role in life in politics has been, you know, one of being an activist, a reformer. And that's, you know, that I just can't see any point in being, you know, a prime minister or a minister and sitting there at your desk and saying, what a good fellow am I, you know, because I've got this big job, and but not actually doing anything with it. But you have to remember that power is an aphrodisiac, and people are attracted to power. They want to be powerful. They want to sit in the big chair. They want to be close. They want to be able to whisper into the ear of the PM or the president and, you know, have that sense of power. Now, they, and this is part of the, you know, really toxic relationship that existed between Murdoch and Trump that had such terrible consequences for the United States. It is, you know, Murdoch is attracted to power. I mean, I've known him for, as I said, nearly 50 years, but he is attracted to power for its own sake. So saying to somebody, why do you want to be powerful, is like saying to someone, why do you want to have sex? You know, it's, you know, why do you want to, you know, wear a beautiful dress or a beautiful suit, you know, and like it's innate. And so that is, that issue of power and personal ambition is absolutely central to politics. I mean, thinking that politicians are all there just focused on particular ideologies or policies is very naive. And increasingly in the rather very fractured political world we live in at the moment, a politician is able to go down just about any rabbit hole to find political support. So, you know, you know, if you think about the old media world, by old I mean say 20 years ago, if you wanted to get your views across to a broad audience, you needed to talk to a producer or an editor or a director at, you know, a major media platform. Nowadays, you can just go out and do your own thing on social media and you can get enormous reach there. At the same time, what we have called mainstream media, like Sky News in Australia, like the Australian newspaper itself, like Fox News, like most of the Murdoch tabloids, they have become just untethered from the facts. And they're now, they sometimes defend themselves by saying that they're really entertainment. That was always Alan Jones's line of defence. And the, you know, you're essentially in this position which, you know, Daniel Moynihan, the New York senator, warned about years ago when he said, you can choose your own opinion, but you can't choose your own facts. Well, the reality is people are now choosing their own facts. And if you have a society, a democracy, in which there isn't a shared set of facts, i.e. we actually agree, you know, what's going on, then you get into, you know, diabolical trouble. You know, when you get a large percentage of the population thinking the election was stolen, or that, you know, global warming is a hoax, or that, you know, the COVID vaccines are going to implant Bill Gates-designed microchips in your brain and turn you into a zombie, you know. This madness is very consequential.
You use that word madness a lot. You use it of your own party. I think you refer to Tony Abbott as crazy, and people even talking in the unravelling of your prime ministership, where Dutton was going for it hell for leather, Abbott wanted it as well, and then Scott Morrison leapfrogged over the top. Oh. Again, it was madness. But I'm not naive about politicians.
Well, I gave Morrison a leg up, you know. I mean, I mean, when the ship was going down, sure. I thought it was.
So you don't believe he betrayed you? You're in two minds in the book as to how much he may have betrayed you.
Look, no, I think Scott's always operated you know, Scott's a very well-known quantity, right? And his people certainly were manoeuvring and helped, you know, helped Dutton in the first instance in the expectation that would make my leadership untenable so that that would create an opportunity for Scott. I mean, it's pretty well documented. He did this with Abbott too. You know, he said that he was supporting Abbott, but he got all his supporters, not that there are a large number of them, but they were significant in the party room. He got his supporters to vote for me on that occasion. So Scott has a history of, you know, if you want to call it duplicity, it's probably that's the best word, but that is his modus operandi. He's, you know, he's kind of known for this, and of course it became a big issue with the French and the submarine deal recently. So
come back, I think that's called lying, telling lies, but anyway, that's another matter. Can we come back to the politicians, though, and their egos and their behaviours? Because naive about politicians, very few of us are. We've seen it all. There's no one who makes it to the top in a cabinet or in a presidential administration who doesn't have an enormous ego and ambition and enjoy power. However, would you argue that Howard got things done, that Keating got things done, that Kevin Rudd, who goes absolutely feral in a phone call on you when you tell him you're not nominating him for the UN boss job, just goes ballistic. Again, an intelligent man who had a policy agenda, including on climate. So the two things don't need to be entirely untethered, being capable of wanting to do good.
No, absolutely not. And Catherine, you've got to be ambitious. You've got to be have self-belief. I mean, just to put up with all the slings and arrows, you've got to have a pretty thick hide. You know, it is a tough line of work. But I guess the question is, the measure is of what you did. And so, you know, my big concern always about Morrison was that he would be a bit like some Labor premiers we've had in Australia over the years, who have been successful getting re-elected and re-elected, but never actually did very much. Now, of course, you know, this Parliament, of course, is completely dominated by COVID. So it's harder to make a clearer judgment. But, you know, for my own part, I realised that I could not rely on being in the job for long. You know, it's a murderous, treacherous business as Australian politics, and you know, you can get bumped off at any time. So that's why I got a lot done. And, you know, I was focused on outcomes. So I think that's ultimately, that's what, you know, the press gallery tend to call politics like a football match and in effect praise people for, you know, a particularly devious manoeuvre which turns out to, you know, win a ballot or, you know, win an election. But as far as serving the national interest is concerned, you've got to focus on what you're actually doing for your country.
And so the media missed
the real game. I mean, politics is like rugby in this sense that, you know, there's a lot of manoeuvring, there's a lot of tactics. It's relative, very important point. You can be a rubbish team, but if the team you play on Saturday are more rubbish than you, you win. Elections can be like that too. But ultimately, it's not a game. I mean, you are basically shaping the future of your country and making changes and reforms which will impact the lives of kids and unborn children, you know, generations to come. So that's, you know, that sounds a bit pious, but you really have to be focused on not just winning elections, that's important, but you've got to be focused on whether you're delivering good public policy for the people.
But this brings us back to climate, and your concerns about Scott Morrison bring us back to what happened in COP26, because this is where climate for 30 or 40 years has drifted and drifted and drifted, while those interest groups have been able to influence the politics. You know, while the denialists have been able to undermine ever-growing science, and while we're still at a point now where we don't have meaningful global action But even in Australia, you mentioned your snowy scheme, Mark, too, which is the pumped hydro scheme, right? That came after the blackouts in South Australia, and everyone said, look, renewables can't work. You also brought in another kind of, or attempting to bring in another kind of energy guarantee, right? And this, again, I think, was right at the end of your tenure, which would ensure that energy providers made sure there was enough supply and help market or help manage the overall market and in a price competitive way. Now, was that another one, again, in domestic politics, that just got defeated by this troika we were discussing before?
Well, the National Energy Guarantee, which was, you know, turned into a big cause célèbre by the right and which ultimately led to the demise of my government or my leadership, it did two things. It was designed to ensure that energy retailers had enough security of energy, so there was enough backup, you know, whether it was batteries or storage or, you know, flexible provision of electricity so that, you know, you could keep the lights on and et cetera. But it also, that part of it has survived. That's now part of the energy market rules in Australia. The other part of it, which was the controversial part, was that retailers should ensure that the emissions profile, that to say the emissions intensity, CO2 emissions intensity of their energy mix was declining in accordance with our international obligations. And that's what the right blew up about. I mean, look, that they had a lot. I mean, ultimately, as Murdoch himself said this, you know, Murdoch was quite happy to bring down my government and see Labor win. I mean, he said to Kerry Stokes, you know, 3 years of Labor wouldn't be so bad, when he was trying to enlist Stokes, another media proprietor, into bringing down my government. I mean, those powerful men, and Murdoch in particular, like prime ministers that basically, you know, pay due deference to them. They're like politicians that do as they're told, bluntly. And, you know, I've never been a very deferential person. So, you know, that's all I've always... So the relationship I always had with the, you know, big end of town and with particularly with the characters like Murdoch was always a little bit vexed, because while people in business would look at me and say, oh, well, you know, Malcolm's been a successful businessman. He understands, you know, free enterprise. He understands the market. That's, you know, that's good in a way that most politicians don't. But on the other hand, the fact that I didn't take instructions, I wasn't, you know, wasn't a, you know, an ass kisser, bluntly, that obviously didn't please them. So, you know, the reality is that, you know, the media proprietors, I mean, they if they choose to, they can exert a huge amount of influence, and they like politicians that suck up to them.
Malcolm, thank you very much. Again, really enjoyed the book. Malcolm Turnbull, A Bigger Picture, is his memoir, published by Hardy Grant Books. 24, it's kind of Succession meets The Thick of It, to be honest, is how I would describe it. And documented out of diaries, obviously one person's perspective on it. But, yeah, certainly a very detailed read of recent Australian politics.